Okay, think this one through, y'all. When was the last time you bought something at a department store? Yeah, it's been a while, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 12th of May. Great to have you here, as always, everybody. We have, as I think I've mentioned before a couple of times, a news meeting around here every morning. We figure out what's going to make it to air, what's not, and then get on about our day. Every now and then, though, there is something, an idea or a pitch or a line that just kind of sticks with me. Today's came from our New York bureau, our reporter there, Mark Garrison, who headlined his memo, Department Store Hellscape. The story, as if you needed more of a clue than that line, is just how rough things are right now for big department stores. Macy's and Kohl's and Nordstrom all came in with disappointing earnings this week. Investors reacted, as you would imagine they would. So the rule is, if you win the news meeting, you get to do the story. Here's Mark.
It raised some eyebrows when Macy's CEO Terry Lundgren said this in a statement this week, quote, "We are not counting on the consumer to spend more." Even in a weak earnings report, it is a rather dim view of the landscape. But it is indeed a challenging time, says Morningstar senior analyst Bridget Weishar.
The department store space in general is in secular decline. If you look at retail sales, it has vastly trailed and actually been negative compared to the general apparel retail market.
There's also the problem of how some stores haven't done much to adapt to all the new competition.
You walk into most department stores and it looks exactly the same as it did 20, 30 years ago.
This is online shopping conditions us to expect every color, size, and style at our fingertips, along with quick checkout and easy returns. Department store execs know they have a challenge, but consumer psychologist Kit Yarrow wonders whether they can meet it.
I think anybody that's been in retail long enough to get to a very senior position in a department store is probably working on an old model. So from my perspective, department stores need to completely transform and most definitely become more consumer-centric.
That can mean everything from better, more personalized customer service to exclusive items. Deloitte Vice Chair Rod Sides worries that too many stores think they can just roll out snazzy tablets and call it a day.
It's not about having the latest gadget and the latest video signage in the store. It really is using digital as a shopping aid to make it more productive, making it more effective, and to be able to allow the consumer to move through more quickly and find what they're looking for.
Otherwise, more and more of them will be looking somewhere else. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We were talking the other day by way of setting up an interview with the CEO of GlaxoSmithKline about all the bigs in this economy. Big tobacco, big oil, big pharma. We're going to coin another one today, big auto. And yes, I know the big three car makers is already a thing. Fine. Don't care about that, though, because we're not talking Detroit. Nissan cut a deal with Mitsubishi today in what both companies are calling a strategic alliance. The idea is to do a lot of sharing, stuff like factories and cutting-edge technologies, because in this global economy, size matters. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that one.
We've heard it in industry after industry. Bigger is better. Carl Brower, an analyst with Kelley Blue Book, says, given the ferocious competition in the car industry, Nissan buying into Mitsubishi is a smart move.
Nissan, like every automaker, is scrambling to grab market share and maintain, if not increase, its global presence.
For Nissan, the deal propels the company into the stratosphere of Toyota, Volkswagen, and GM. In today's climate, the thinking is if you're a smaller player, you need deep pockets to weather what's coming. One challenge, says Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Kevin Tynan, is consumer demand may be peaking.
We probably don't need as many automakers pumping out as many vehicles. I think there's probably too many automakers that don't do enough volume.
Car makers are also sprinting to keep up with the rapid pace of technology. Companies used to design a car and leave it unchanged for 7 years. Now it's every 3 to 5, adding tons of pressure and new costs. Of course, potential mergers and behemoth car companies raises a threat of higher prices. But IHS automotive analyst Stephanie Brindley says that's not why we'll end up paying more for our cars and trucks.
What's going to drive prices more likely than consolidation is the fact that we still have future fuel economy and fuel emission regulations to meet.
Brindley expects there'll be fewer car companies on the planet in 10 years' time, but she says wait around long enough and new players will spring up. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
There was a brief shining moment today when Apple wasn't the most valuable publicly traded company on the planet. What was? Oh, you're going to have to stick around for that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Gotta be mobile if you want to be anywhere in the 21st century, right? Portable, accessible, reaching people where they are. It's true in the digital economy, and it's true in the healthcare economy, too. Yes, there is always going to be a fixed medical infrastructure, but mobile is at least part of our healthcare future. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman explains.
This is mobile health that doesn't fit in a phone.
Okay, when's your birthday?
9389. In fact, it's 40 feet long and looks like a mix between an RV, a school bus, and a doctor's office. It's a mobile health clinic.
Okay, you can step on the scale.
Patient Hannah Salam gets weighed, then she slips her tattooed arm into the blood pressure cuff. She got out of prison a few months ago and is staying at a halfway house before she's off parole. The mobile clinics run by Parkland Hospital make stops throughout Dallas County to domestic violence shelters, daycare centers, drug treatment facilities, and behavioral health programs.
I'm coming to get the test results of my lab for my thyroid problems.
The key word there is results. She's on this van to get the results of a lab test she got on another mobile van run by Parkland. See, follow-up is really tricky for patients who don't have cars or who are switching between shelters or apartments.
Their access to health care is much more difficult.
Susan Spaulding is medical director of Parkland's Homeless Outreach Medical Services Program.
They have issues with transportation, with health insurance, with getting prescriptions, with competing priorities, so that health care is not nearly as important as getting food and shelter.
Spaulding says these homeless adults and kids face the same health problems as everyone else: high blood pressure, diabetes, asthma, but they often end up in the emergency room instead of a doctor's office. The hospital wants to change that. The mobile vans make it as easy as possible to get help, and they've been popular. Last year, 9,000 homeless Dallas residents got on board for free care. More than 1,500 of them were kids.
Many people throughout the country use mobile clinics once or twice a week. We run our mobile clinics Monday through Friday, 8 in the morning till sometimes 8 at night. And so there are a lot of people in and out.
It turns out nationwide, mobile health clinics are having a bit of a renaissance moment.
There are a lot of mobile clinics in the U.S. right now, many more than many people might imagine.
Katarina Hill is a research associate at Harvard Medical School who's been tracking this trend. She says there are more than 2,000 mobile clinics in the U.S. Some hospitals are investing in these clinics on wheels because they're shifting their focus from the ER to managing chronic illness and preventative care. Rigging up the vans with all the standard medical equipment isn't cheap. But Hill's research shows in the long term, it saves money.
We've estimated that an average visit to a mobile clinic costs the funder about $155, but saves 12 times that in terms of long-term health benefits and avoided emergency department visits.
So why aren't more healthcare systems using them? Hill says there hasn't been much published research on how effective the clinics are. That's contributed to skepticism and a bit of an image problem. She says people sometimes assume the quality of healthcare isn't as high because it's delivered in the community on a bus.
So that's why we're trying to build the evidence base around it so that people are aware of it as a tool to help healthcare systems really try and improve the health of those that need it most.
The mobile clinic program in Dallas is experimenting with rounding out those services, adding social workers, dentists, and psychologists. Soon, it might be time for a double-decker. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Want to upset digital natives and even those of us who aren't natives but who live there? Go ahead and mess around with our phone screens. That'll do the trick. Instagram unveiled a new logo yesterday, and it didn't take long for plenty of its 400 million users to protest, yours truly included. The quite spiffy, in my humble opinion, retro camera logo has been replaced by a slicker, more colorful, only remotely camera-like thing with way less, to certain eyes anyway, appeal. Still, Instagram, like all businesses, must have had reasons for the change. Ashley Milne-Tite takes a look.
When Instagram launched 6 years ago, it was a new thing, and it used its Polaroid-style logo to convey what it did. The new logo still includes a camera, but the background is orangey-purple and the design is flatter, more abstract. Sven Seeger is with branding agency Future Brand. He says nowadays, Instagram has so many millions of users
that the literal depiction is not needed anymore because everybody knows Instagram. They could have had any logo. They could be completely abstract.
Armin Witt is editor of the blog Brand New. He says Instagram was due for a makeover. It's outgrown its crafty feel.
Now it's more of a social media platform that is highly embraced, and I think it has to look more like it belongs with other things like Airbnb, Facebook, and Twitter, which it wasn't doing with the old look.
Witt says the bolder logo with the neon colors makes it stand out more in a sea of apps on your phone. Erna Alfred Liusas of Forrester Research says that may be true, but nonetheless, she feels slighted.
It literally feels like, thank you, customer. We've been together for so long, but we've made this decision, which we think is minor, but it's something that really means something to you, and we didn't have the dialogue with you. Sorry.
I mean, are you going to leave Instagram because of this?
No, I'm not.
This is the way of the social media world, after all. Change, complain, post a selfie, repeat. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
They got us right where they want us, yeah? For its many virtues, Whole Foods isn't known for its low prices, hence the whole paycheck nickname thing. But the company's brand managers are nothing if not savvy. Whole Foods is introducing a new chain of stores this month called 365, aimed squarely at the younger, more frugal shoppers out there. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
The higher-ups at Whole Foods generally know the kind of person who shops there. Jeff Turnus is the president of the new concept. The store is named after Whole Foods' house brand, 365. You might call it 365. But who's going to shop there?
I think it'll be diverse, but I think the real exciting thing is those who don't shop with Whole Foods or haven't shopped with Whole Foods.
Phil Limpert runs the website supermarketguru.com. He's a little skeptical about how Whole Foods is going to find these new shoppers. After all, it's taking over an old Kroger supermarket in a strip mall.
Frankly, it looks like a 1950s, you know, Pantry Pride or Safeway store. So I don't know, once we get in the store, whether or not it's really going to be warm, curated. That's really going to dictate whether or not millennials are going to shop there.
Once you get in, you're going to be greeted by a lot of the store's namesake proprietary brand, which costs less than some of the fancier things you find at Whole Foods. Whole Foods also runs its own restaurants and coffee bars in its stores. This store is partnering with a restaurant in New York and an independent coffee company to run the coffee bar.
Why have they decided not to do that? And the answer that comes to mind is that these other brands are stronger with millennials than either Whole Foods or 365.
And investors are hoping this new concept can turn things around. Whole Foods stock got crushed after several quarters of sluggish sales. This year, it's been down as much as 40% over 2015. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You can't just cut it off and say sink or swim, because we're talking about people.
People who are struggling in places that are struggling. Welfare reform 20 years on. But first, let's do the numbers. A lot of sound and fury, and then a whole lot of nothing. The Dow Industrials bounced around a lot today, ticked up 9 points at the bell, less than a tenth percent, 17,720. The NASDAQ down 23 points, about a half percent, 47.37. The S&P 500 basically flat. 2,064. Monsanto up 8% today and reports the Germany's Bayer, or Bayer perhaps, is exploring a $40 billion bid for the seed and chemical company. Jack in the Box reported better than expected results for the latest quarter. Shares up 15%. McDonald's up 0.75%. Listen, even Chipotle had a good day. Shares climbed 0.6% today. As we talked about earlier, retail earnings have taken a beating, but Walmart got a bump today on news it's testing a $49 monthly subscription fee for two-day unlimited delivery. Shares up 0.6%. All right, so it was Google that was bigger than Apple for just a bit, but GOOG is the ticker symbol, faded at the bell. Both of those companies, by the way, worth about $500 billion apiece. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tell me if this sounds familiar, all right? You check the cupboards, you make your grocery list, you go to the store, you buy maybe some comparison shopping, and then you go home. Oh, that it were so simple. Groceries account for about a quarter of all sales at Target. So now the Minneapolis-based big box retailer has teamed up with the MIT Media Lab and the design firm IDEO to figure out why people buy food the way they do and, not coincidentally, how Target can sell more of it. Marketplace's Annie Baxter got to see some of those experiments play out up close and personal at a Target store in Edina, Minnesota.
Megan Wallowitz seems a little puzzled by the attention she's getting in the Target produce section.
I just came over here to get something for lunch.
Gotcha.
Little does she know, she's in the middle of an experiment. There's a big sign hanging over the strawberries and raspberries. It indicates about half the berries arrived today and cost $2.99 a package. The other half arrived a week earlier and cost 50 cents less. Seijin Takamura is one of the Target people researching the future of food, and he wants Wallowitz's take on the signs.
Did you notice the signs before I pointed them out to you just now?
Yes. Or
you did?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about how that influenced what you were looking at, if at all.
Are shoppers more compelled by freshness or price? The answers on this day are kind of all over the map. Wallowitz, for example, says she actually prefers older berries.
Just for the fact that they might be a little bit sweeter because they had a little bit more time to ripen.
For shopper Betty Johnson, the opposite is true.
I would never buy the raspberries that are a week old because they spoil so quickly.
Meanwhile, Emmy Schmidt, a working mom, is all about the price.
I didn't really look at the date, to be honest. Okay. I looked at the 50 cents off.
Target is betting that making sense of these different answers will help it distinguish its grocery business. Casey Carl is Target's chief strategy and innovation officer. He says grocery already accounts for about $20 billion in sales, but Target wants that to grow, hence all the research.
It's already a sizable book of business, so we need to understand and look more effectively around corners of what's coming and figure out how we can create opportunity in that.
They don't necessarily have a lot of equity in this space because they didn't really do such a great job with grocery in the past.
Amy Koo is with the research firm Kantar Retail. She says Target's grocery business has been dogged by problems.
They were often out of stock or items were not as fresh as they should be for guests. But they're really trying to turn the page on this.
Back at the grocery store, Greg Shoemaker, Target's entrepreneur in residence, shows off a mock-up of what he calls a food transparency scale. It's a real scale. The idea is that you'd put a food item on it and see a list of things you might want to know about the product.
Freshness, brand reputation, production and storage chemicals, ingredients, animal welfare.
It's the kind of information consumers seem to crave lately. But a couple hours go by and hardly anyone touches the thing.
So it seems like there aren't a ton of takers on the scale yet.
Yeah, I know. Which is interesting, right? Like people's willingness to interact with technology. I think it's a really interesting finding.
Still, Shoemaker's not discouraged. He says it's still early days for the experiments, and it'll take a while to figure out just how much transparency consumers really want about the food they buy and how Target should provide it. In Edina, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
We've got a new thing going on with our Wealth and Poverty Desk, a podcast called The Uncertain Hour. And this first season that has just started is all about what we know about welfare reform 20 years after we ended welfare as we know it. It was a domestic policy high point for President Clinton, but in the cold light of history, sometimes things look different. Our senior correspondent, Chrissy Clark, has the preview of this week's episode. Hey, Chrissy.
Hey, Kai.
So you have been looking into how all these changes, like work requirements, played out in the lives of actual real people.
Yeah.
20 years ago, it turns out, on this very radio program, we profiled a woman who was, like, moving into that new system. Her name was Josephine Moore. She lived in rural West Virginia up in coal country.
Right. Yeah. Way before you or I were here at Marketplace, we talked to this woman on the show, this woman named Josephine Moore, or Jo for short. She was a single mom with six kids. Her husband was in prison. She'd been on and off welfare for over a decade when we met her, trying to support her kids on her own. And she lived in this little coal mining town in West Virginia called Kermit. Wow. It was super depressed. Here she is in 1997 from back then, giving a tour of the place.
This used to be an IGA and a Piggly Wiggly's groceries, but it went out of business. This used to be a shoe store. It went out of business about 6 months ago.
And so the deal was, of course, given how bad the economy was back then, she was worried about how she was going to get by after all the work requirements and time limits and all that.
Right, exactly. And she was really frank about this.
Everybody that's on welfare in the United States, I don't know how they're going to get everybody a job. I just don't know how. I don't think they can. You can't just cut it off and say sink or swim, because we're talking about people.
You being the reporter I know you to be, you went out and found her, didn't you?
We did. Me and our crack team of producers. We found Jo.
Hi.
Hello.
Come on in. Don't take your boots off.
So nice to meet you.
You too.
So today, Jo is 59. Mm-hmm. She still lives in Kermit, West Virginia, in this small trailer up a very steep and muddy driveway, which is why you could hear me panting.
Huffing and puffing, yeah.
So that's why I'm panting in that day.
So what's the answer to the question? Did she sink or did she swim, like she was talking about?
Well, I guess the short answer is she's treading water.
Huh.
Since welfare reform kicked in, she never went back on welfare, and neither have her kids. She has had a series of jobs, and her kids have too, but they're not especially high-paying jobs. They are jobs, though.
Yeah.
She's worked at a bunch of customer service call centers, a Tyson chicken plant.
Ooh, that's rough work.
Yeah.
Nothing smells like that chicken skin stuff that they peel off. And when that stuff gets filled up in that car, oh, Lord. Turn your stomach, but then you learn to breathe through your mouth, and it's not bad at all.
Man, tell me then how this fits in with the national trend in welfare reform.
So it is true that after welfare reform, single mothers did have higher rates of employment. And that was true across the country. But if you drill down on those statistics, they get a little more complicated. For one, overall, the economy was doing better in the mid to late 90s. Right. So there were just more jobs to be had. And for another, the jobs that many single mothers did get, like Jo, they were really low paying. And wages have been stagnating since then. So even if they got off welfare and into jobs, it's not like they've seen a lot of economic mobility. Here's Jo and her daughter, Carolina, talking about that.
Yeah, I'm poor. Always been poor.
Poor, just trying to make it.
So if they're still poor, but they're not on welfare, how do they get by?
Well, that's one of the really big questions in the wake of welfare reform, because across the country, welfare rolls have dropped. There are far fewer people on welfare. But a lot of them either have these sorts of low-paying jobs and are still hovering just above poverty, or they've fallen out of the workforce entirely. And so to make ends meet, people have gone to some pretty shocking lengths, things like selling plasma.
Mm-hmm.
They stick a needle in your arm, which I have a scar like right here from where they used to do it. Take about an hour and a half, and then they would give you 20 for your first visit for the week and then 30 for your second visit for the week, and then you could do it weekly.
That was Jo's daughter, Estella. And in fact, in the last 20 years, following welfare reform, the U.S. has become known as the OPEC of plasma. Because researchers actually connect some of this growth to the fact that there are very few ways to get cash assistance now. And so selling plasma is a way to get cash when you don't have cash welfare.
Man, those stories and more coming up on the new podcast from our Wealth and Poverty Desk. It is called The Uncertain Hour, featuring Chrissy Clark. Thank you, Chrissy.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, some of the fine print from a Wall Street research report out the other day. These are the people we're talking about when we say Wall Street analysts, as we sometimes do. Anyway, this report from Bernstein Research was on the future of the video economy, YouTube, Amazon, and all the rest. The caveat here is that YouTube doesn't disclose its actual numbers, but Bernstein's estimates are kind of mind-boggling. Here's one of them. To date, they say YouTube videos have been watched an estimated 39 trillion times for approximately 196 trillion minutes, or let me do the math for you, nearly 400 million years. Right? Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks so much for listening to Marketplace. You hear me do the numbers every day, but we aim to bring you more than the numbers. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. We'd like you to help keep our numbers strong by making a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace. And this month, your gift in any amount is going to be automatically doubled thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. So please donate today at marketplace.org. Even if you do the regression analysis and take out the cat videos, that's still like a whole lot of time, right? The Dow up 9 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 23 points, about a 0.5%. The S&P 500, bupkis. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. We wanted to introduce you to a new podcast from Marketplace brought to you by the Wealth and Poverty Desk. It's called The Uncertain Hour. You could think of it as a docupod. It dives deep into the uncertainties of our economy in ways you don't often hear. We think, well, we know, actually, you're going to enjoy it. Also, it's not actually an hour, more like, you know, standard podcast length, 20, 30 minutes. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.